Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is November 23rd, 2021, and my guest is author Frank Rose. He's faculty director of Columbia University's Executive Education Seminar, Strategic Storytelling, and heads the Digital Dozen Awards program at Columbia's Digital Storytelling Lab. This is Frank's second appearance on the program. He was here in October of 2011, a long time ago, discussing his book, The Art of Immersion. Our topic for today is his new book, The Sea We Swim In. Frank, welcome back to Econ Talk.
Thank you, Russ. Great to be here.
What is the sea we swim in, and why is that the title of your book?
Well, the sea we swim in this case, is stories. And I was the title was inspired by a quote from Jerome Bruner, the psychologist who was, you know, one of the most influential people in his field in the 20th century. And he was a leader of the revolt against behaviorism in the 1950s. He's one of the founders of cognitive psychology. And in the mid 80s, he started getting more and more interested in stories. And he wrote a book which was largely called Actual Minds, Possible Worlds, which was largely about the idea that stories constitute a distinct line of thought, a distinct mode of thought, and one that is so ubiquitous, that is surrounds us so much that we don't even see it. You know, and as he said, as the fish in the proverb doesn't understand what water is, so we don't understand that we live in a sea of stories.
I very much think that's true. In fact, I believe that much of our reality is the stories we tell ourselves. They're not the stories that they're not bedtime stories, and they're not necessarily the plots of movies, but they're stories nonetheless. Narrative is a crucial part of our human experience. But it's interesting to me. I didn't notice it until I thought about Immersion, your first book, The Art of Immersion. Both of them have a water motif. is that deliberate or a coincidence?
No, that's entirely coincidence. In fact, I'm not sure I even quite recognized it until just now.
Okay. Let's start off talking about internet storytelling, because your first book was really about how the internet opened up a whole new form of narrative for people. How much has changed since that first book, in your view? It's been 10 years, which is like a century of internet time. How has the narrative use of the internet for narrative purposes changed?
It has. Well, a key point of the book was that every time there's a new medium, a new communications medium that comes along, it takes people 20, 30, 40 years, however long, to figure out what to do with it, to develop a form of narrative that is native to that medium. You saw it with movies. The motion picture camera was invented around 1890, and it was nonetheless the mid-19-teens before you regularly had feature-length films with stars that use all of the techniques that we now associate with the grammar of cinema, like cuts, pans, fades, and so forth. And, of course, another decade after that before you had sound. What's happening with the internet is analogous, except it's more complicated because the technology keeps sort of, you know, rushing ahead. When I wrote The Art of Immersion, you know, at that point, virtual reality was still something that was you know, remembered from the early 90s when Jaron Lanier had his, you know, lab and people, you know, everybody got excited about that. Just a couple of years after it came out, you know, VR became a whole big thing again and an entirely new form with the launch of Oculus and so forth. So there are multiple kinds of storytelling that have, you know, been emerging. For example, podcasts. Podcasts were, you know, I think they were around in 2011, but they certainly weren't, you know, as ubiquitous as they are today. So I think what's happening is that we're continuing to find new means of storytelling means that are native to the internet, and it's going to be quite a while before we really, you know, settle down into a, you know, regular format. Number one, I don't think there will be just one format, and number two, we'll have to see what the proverbial metaverse does for us. Not at all clear at this point.
You know, I was talking to someone recently about the radio program The Shadow, which I knew from my childhood. My dad had told me about it, and on some late night drives, even as an adult, I would find The Shadow being replayed over, you know, AM radio as I was going cross country. Now going cross-country, of course, a lot of people listen to podcasts. They also listen to books on tape, but clearly a mistake when you listen to a podcast. But I'm kidding. But what's interesting, I didn't think about it, the rise of the long-form multiple-episode podcast like Serial, which I think was one of the first crime-lengthy multiple-episode series. It's kind of just going back to The Shadow, except you could listen to it when you wanted to, right? They're always looking for sound effects and other ways to make it more than just listening. You know, when they call a guest, they interview someone, you'll hear the phone ringing. Podcasts do those kind of things. Those are, you know, primitive shout-outs to the early days of radio. And, of course, podcasting is just really radio with different deliveries. It's just audio. Is what right. Radio is. So anyway, it's kind of hadn't thought about that.
Yeah, no, exactly. And, you know, one thing that fascinates me about podcasts and VR is that, you know, throughout the last, say, 150 years at least, the tendency with technology has been to create forms of storytelling or give rise to, I should say, forms of storytelling that provide more and more detail and leave less and less to the imagination. You know, obviously, in the early 19th century, you had novels, and you know, before that even. Then you had cycloramas in the post-Civil War period in the U.S., where, you know, people would go to see dramatic reconstructions almost of Civil War battles and, you know, even the crucifixion. And then you had movies. And suddenly with the rise of movies, the emergence of movies, cycloramas looked kind of tawdry and cheap, and they were completely abandoned. And then, of course, you had radio, and then you had television. And what is happening with VR, it seems to be kind of the ultimate extension of that, providing more and more detail, leaving less and less to the imagination of the audience. And yet podcasting is exactly the opposite. So I think I'm fascinated by the fact, and when you think about it, I'm not terribly surprised by the fact that these two things are happening at the same time.
Well, the rise of visual media, movies, the bingeable miniseries on Netflix or Amazon Prime, you know, there is a certain laziness to that compared to a book and even to an audio, because you're seeing it all. In theory, there's nothing left to the imagination. But, of course, there are ways to make to use imagination and visual storytelling I remember, and I think it's in M, Peter Lorre does something horrific to somebody, and it's off camera,
right?
And it's left to the imagination. That was an early way that people did that. But you could argue that in modern times, people just want it easy. They don't want to have to work at trying to figure out what's going on. As you point out in your book, a number of modern storytelling, Pulp Fiction, the movie, Christopher Nolan's movies, they're often so convoluted in the narrative style that the viewer has plenty to do. So they invite multiple, just like as books do, and sometimes podcasts, they invite multiple listening because you want to think about it some more or try to figure out something that you didn't notice the first time. So it's I think this question of how much work you have to do is a feature and a bug for different people at different times. And sometimes you just want to lay back and be entertained, and other times you want to be immersed in something that's very thought-provoking. And so I think it makes sense that they're both happening at the same time.
Yeah, I agree.
Now, a lot of your book, a chunk of your book's about advertising and the way that companies tell their story in the 21st century. I've been intrigued by this for a while. I may have even talked about it on Econ Talk. Some of the best storytellers in the world today are ad agencies that are telling stories in very modern lengths, 60 seconds. Sometimes you get a trailer, actually, of a movie is now it's a story in and of itself. Sometimes you don't need to see the movie after you watch the trailer, but it's a 2.5-minute exposition. Why has narrative become so ubiquitous in advertising? My father would say, "I don't get that ad." And of course, sometimes you're not supposed to. It's just a story sometimes, or it's a story where the product's embedded. But it's clear to me that what you identified back in 2011 and what you talk about in this new book is a very, very powerful theme in advertising, especially. Storytelling is memorable, can create an emotional connection. What's happening there, and how is it changing advertising?
Well, as you say, storytelling is memorable. And in one of his books, Roger Shank, one of the pioneers of artificial intelligence, writes that human memory is story-based. And that's because I think stories give us a sort of emotional hook. That's how we remember things. That's what prompts us to remember things. We can memorize the state capitals, but it's not going to stay with us very long. And that's, I think, kind of the problem with data and the challenge of using data to tell stories. In terms of advertising, I mean, it's a great question. And there are several things that are happening here. One is the sort of demise of interruptive advertising. People just don't want it. They never did want it, but until fairly recently, they didn't have any choice. You had to, sit back and watch TV through the ads, even though everybody knew that you weren't actually sitting back and watching the ads. You were going to the refrigerator, you're going to the bathroom, whatever. This was an open secret, but never acknowledged by the industry. With the emergence of the remote, for TVs, this began to change. And then, you had in the early internet era, you had the rise of services that, streaming services and so forth that enabled you, at least theoretically, to jump through the ads. And, network executives went nuts. I'm talking obviously about TiVo and things like that. Network executives went nuts, even as they themselves were using these devices. And so, as I say, a couple of things are happening here. One of them is that if you need to, if you're in a battle for attention, one of the best ways to get somebody's attention is to hook them with a story. And, we are it's well known that we are in a battle for attention that's been increasingly hard for, decades. Herbert Simon at the end of the 60s wrote about this, spoke about what's now considered or called the attention economy. But it's only gotten worse, much worse since his time. And so there's that. The other thing is, of course, stories are entertaining. So if you want somebody to pay attention to you, one thing you have to do is entertain them. And another thing is, there's been a growing realization, because of a lot of work in cognitive psychology and neuroscience, that when we tell people to buy something, it doesn't work. It just doesn't. This has been derided by people at the Advertising Research Foundation as the input output model of advertising. You pour some facts into the viewer's head or the listener's head, and that comes out as a purchase. It's ridiculous. This is a philosophy that goes back to the very early 60s, late 50s, with Rosser Reeves, who was the head of the Ted Bates Advertising Agency at that time, and wrote a book called Reality in Advertising, in which he argued for the unique selling proposition, the USP, the idea that every product had to have every product had to have some reason to buy it. And you had to, as an advertiser, your job was to find out what that reason was and shout it out to the world. He made merciless fun of brands like Coca-Cola for not, doing this. As it happens, Coke was doing fine at the time and has continued to do so. Yeah. So it really comes down, I think, to entertainment and to memory. Hooking people with an emotional memory, an emotional delivery that sticks in their minds.
And you say in your book, you don't say it, both these things at the same time, but you effectively say what Ed Lemer has said on this program and in his book on macroeconomics. Man is a storytelling, pattern-seeking animal. And pattern-seeking really is storytelling is a form of pattern-seeking. It's trying to make make coherent your mind a set of events that may or may not go together. When they do, though, it becomes much, as you say, much easier to remember, and it's more compelling. It's what, I like to argue with no facts whatsoever, that our brain is probably designed for listening to stories. It's certainly not designed for watching movies. It could be coincidentally good at it, but if anything, we evolved to hear stories around the campfire and at the bedside. It's the nature of most of human history. So it must have. Would not be unsurprising if our brains were wired that way.
Right.
Let's talk about some brands that you talk about in the book. And I find I'm a little bit perplexed by this, but there's a rise of products that where the story is not so much. Let's say, Coca-Cola is a very good storytelling brand. Budweiser is a very good storytelling brand. As you point out in the book, I'm sure it sells product, but it certainly does remind people that the ad exists, if nothing else. But a lot of these new products that are out, that are basically internet marketed, are stories about the founders and their narrative of how they got interested in changing, say, the shaving business or the shirt business or the you name it business. And I find that fascinating. I personally am not a millennial, as everyone knows who listens to this program, but the implication of your book is that there are a lot of millennials who relate to this more than say my generation, that they want to know, what the founders had in mind and their journey, and the founders use that. They I get emails from some products that I buy from the founders as if we have a personal relationship. You know, they really appreciate that I bought their shirt, and they, you know, not just the corporate appreciation, but the founder, the director of marketing, you know, he's only uses his first name. What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a fascinating development. Well, you know, it was over 10 years ago that Simon Sinek had a bestseller with that was called Start With Why. The point of which was...
Start With Why, the question.
Why. The point of that he was trying to make was that people don't care quite so much what you do as why you do it. That's what differentiates you from everybody else. And I thought that was a really, you know, major insight. And it's certainly in line with what you're talking about here. You know, I think that millennials in particular, and I'm certainly not one either, but it seems, you know, pretty apparent that they are not, and younger people in general are not, you know, so much interested in going to advertising or any form of corporate communication to find out information about the products. If you want to find out information about, you know, a dishwasher, a car, a vacuum cleaner, whatever, there's no end of it available online. You know, you can Google it and you'll have hundreds of thousands of results in a fraction of a second. So what is interesting to people is who is behind this and why are they doing it? And I think that's really, you know, what's at issue here. I think a contributing factor is that, you know, these are all direct-to-consumer brands, and you know, direct-to-consumer really wasn't possible until around 2010, 2011. And suddenly it's, you know, not only possible, but has become, you know, ubiquitous. And when you have a direct-to-consumer brand, it means, you know, of course, there's no middleman, which is great. But also, you know, there's no shelf space. There's no, you know, way to reach people except through, you know, videos online, you know, that sort of thing, through your website, through the packaging on your products. And the fact that I think people are increasingly, you know, I'm not sure if suspicious is exactly the word, but, you know, not taken with corporate, you know, lingo, corporate communication. They'd much rather have it from, at least appear to come from an individual.
Yeah. But and that why part, you know, going, you used the example of Warby Parker, the eyeglass chain, not chain, brand, something of a chain now, but, you know, the struggle of the founders to enter this giant marketplace where they're just a little David to the Goliath of the existing competitors, or Harry's Shave Club, which neither of which, by the way, are sponsors of Econ Talk. We take no money from them. Just mentioning it. You know, they're taking on Gillette. I don't know. It's interesting that I just care if they shave well or if the glasses are attractive. But you're suggesting that people actually care about the journey of how the founders came into the experience.
Yeah, you know, clearly they do. I mean, that certainly seems to be what's happening. And, you know, one of the reasons for this, I think, is that certainly in the case of Warby Parker and Harry's, a key selling point of these products is that they're inexpensive by comparison with, you know, what you would get if you walked into a regular eyeglasses store, or if you, you know, bought Gillette razor blades, and razors and so forth. And so, therefore, it becomes kind of imperative to explain why they're inexpensive and why they can be inexpensive and yet as good or better than the products that you're used to. So a big part of the origin story, certainly for these two brands, is about just that. In the case of Warby Parker, it was, one of the four founders. These were four guys at Wharton at the time. One of them was getting off an airplane in Chiang Mai in Thailand and realized that he'd left his $700 pair of Prada sunglasses in the seat back, in front of him. So by then it was too late to go get it back. So the more they studied the situation, the more they realized that the entire eyeglasses industry was dominated by this Italian company, Luxottica, which controlled pretty much every aspect of the business and therefore was able to charge quite inflated prices for things. So that became a key part of their origin story. It wasn't just about them. It was also about Luxottica. Sort of the same with Harry's and Gillette. There's a sense in which all of these origin stories, they tie in a more or less subtle way to the basic sales proposition, which is, this is what we have to offer and this is why it's cheap.
Yeah, we don't have a warehouse or a display lot, and we pass the savings on to you.
Exactly.
It could be true, but sometimes it's not. It's just, as you say, it's a way to try to justify what they hope is an attractive product at a reasonable price. I want to talk about movie franchises for a minute. You write about in the book Star Wars, Lord of the Rings. Lord of the Rings, of course, began as a book franchise, not as a movie, became a movie.
Right.
And you point out in a rather lovely way that there was a long before those two iconic names, there was Sherlock Holmes, and that Arthur Conan Doyle kind of tried to kill him off and fail because people were so eager for the next episode. So just talk about that generally. I think the long form story, of which Sherlock Holmes is an example, they were short stories, but we were always eager as the reader to hear the next one. If you were a contemporary of Arthur Conan Doyle at the time, there were so many TV miniseries where you feel that, okay, after the second or third season, they're done, and now I'm in a soap opera. They're going to jerk me around as a viewer, and they run out of new ideas, and I usually bail at that point. But people like that. They like to know that there's another episode coming eventually, and they run many times, I think, for longer than they should if they wanted to be a well-rounded story. A lot of the times, they just don't care. They're just going to keep entertaining you for a while, and we'll talk about endings in a minute. But just talk about that phenomenon generally and the idea of this episodic long-form story, Chapter X of Star Wars or the next Marvel movie. They're all this ongoing franchise.
Yes. Again, a couple of things going on there, and I think this is really a fascinating development. Part of it is that we like to immerse ourselves in stories, and I wrote about that, of course, in The Art of Immersion, but I look at it in a bit more detail, actually, in this book, in The Sea We Swim In, and what's happening is, again, it's something that we've always wanted to do, throw ourselves into the world of the story. If it's a story that matters to us, if it's a story that really appeals to us or speaks to us in some relatively deep fashion. Given that, why would you want the story to end? Also, when you have stories that do come to an end after a very long period, Lost being a classic example, another example being Game of Thrones, it's all too easy to screw up. You know, you can screw up the ending apparently very, very easily. And both of those franchises, you know, both of those television series did in a way that, you know, left a lot of their fans pretty unhappy. So so in a way, it's almost better if you can avoid coming to an end, or at least coming to a final end. You know, each, I mean, it's like the Star Wars franchise. Each of the movies tells its own story, but then there's an ongoing story, you know, with that. And this has to do also with the rise of what's called the story world. You know, it used to be the setting. We just had a setting for a story, and that was fine. And you know, we watched or read or whatever, and we imagined ourselves, you know, in this place. But nobody thought too much about it. But with the rise of neuroscience and the gradual understanding, or seeming understanding at least, that we process stories by literally imagining ourselves in the within the world where the story is happening, by identifying with one of the main characters, by imaginatively projecting ourselves into the story. This idea of the setting doesn't really satisfy anymore. It's more than a setting. It's a whole world that you want to that people want to throw themselves into if your story is going to be successful. And although this has become more prevalent in the digital era, certainly, as you say, with Sherlock Holmes, there's nothing all that new about it. Sherlock Holmes was an extreme example, but even after Conan Doyle died in, I think, 1930 or so, you know, there arose these clubs that in London and New York and elsewhere, which promoted the fiction that these stories were true, that Sherlock Holmes actually existed, and that Arthur Conan Doyle was merely his literary agent. And everybody knew that this was not the case, but they proceeded in anyway, you know, with sort of a wink. And this is sort of the birth of a really obsessive kind of fandom, which we now see all around us. But with Sherlock Holmes, it was still new.
And of course, you can always tell a new Sherlock Holmes story, maybe not legally, but I don't know who owns the rights to it. But what's interesting about what you're saying, I never thought about it, is that, you know, these characters, they do exist. They're fictional, but they exist, and they are immortal, many of them. And the Benedict Cumberbatch, Martin Freeman series, Sherlock, is a magnificent bit of visual storytelling using a modern version with some modern overlay, visual overlay of Sherlock's genius on screen. And it's just lovely. It's very, very, very well done. But I think what's interesting is that, you know, I didn't watch Friends. I don't think I've ever seen a whole episode of it, and I wasn't a Seinfeld fan. But these TV series, which are sort of the predecessors of, say, the Netflix series that are so high end, you know, they're your friends. They're the people you hang out with on Tuesday night or whatever it was on. And the reason they're compelling is that we know their character, right? We know the reason. There's a lot of things that make them interesting, but their distinctiveness is part of what makes it compelling. We expect certain things from certain of the characters, and when they surprise us, which they sometimes do for different reasons, in terms of enhancing the plot or the intrigue, it's just like one of our regular friends doing it. But I want to talk about it. And so we hang out with them,
right?
And we miss them. And when the show goes off the air, we watch the reruns, and I'm on my second or third time through Stiesel. The characters there I thought were so well done. I don't mind hearing again what they said. I don't remember them that well. It's kind of like when you go back to, you know, you have a reunion with a friend you haven't seen in a few years. They tell you a story that they told you before, but you don't remember it that well, and you like them, so you don't mind hearing it again. It's kind of comforting. It's like bedtime stories we hear over and over again. But I want to talk about endings. You know, I had Paul Bloom on the program recently, and he talked about how endings are different than beginnings, that, you know, that a period of suffering that is redeemed at the end by you know, exuberant joy, say, is very different than a little bit of joy, a lot of joy that ends in suffering. We like the ending typically to be a good ending. It, there's a redemptive piece to that, and it's part of our mind organized around stories. We can't just say, well, half it was good, half it was bad. We want the half that's good to be at the end. We don't want it to be at the beginning. We care about the narrative arc of life and in stories as well. And I'm fascinated by this idea that these franchises that were extraordinary, like Lost or Game of Thrones, neither of which I saw, by the way. I think I saw the first episode of Lost. That people feel like, how'd you do that? Why did you end it so badly, in contrast to a show like The Americans that you mentioned, which ends magnificently in my mind as a story. It's very powerful. You know, part of the reason we want to watch these ongoing was not just we want to hang out with our friends, we want to know how it turns out, right? We have this curiosity, and I think that's part of the reason that endings are so important. And I am bewildered that shows struggle to end. Do they just run out of ideas? Are they bored, the writers? It's such a huge opportunity. For me, the ending of a book is enormously important. Why would you not, savor and try to perfect the ending of your series? What's going on there?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and frankly, I don't know, and I don't think the showrunners do either, which is probably why the ending wasn't successful.
good one.
With Lost, you can see the problem.
That's true.
Yeah.
No spoilers here, but there's a mystery at the heart of it that doesn't maybe hold together so well, so they're kind of stuck.
Yeah.
Yeah,
exactly. And with Game of Thrones, I don't know. That one really, it surprised me that it was not more successful. I don't know. I think that ending a story may be even harder than beginning it. And beginning a story is pretty hard. As somebody who spent a lot of time as a journalist and, written a few narrative nonfiction books, I can tell you. And at least with journalism, you have an ending that, nobody can really argue with. But with fictional stories
You mean the truth.
Yes, yes.
Whatever it is.
Yeah. Exactly.
And even more importantly, if the ending's not good, you just don't write that story, right? True ending's like, you can pick a better one.
Right. Exactly. But people do expect some kind of, redemptive quality at the end.
Or closure.
Yeah, although why anybody would expect that with Game of Thrones is sort of beyond me. I mean, this is a series that violated all the rules, starting with the fact that your main characters were killed off in the first episodes. So of course it's not going to have a redemptive ending. But in any case, this brings to mind what's called the peak end rule, right? Which I believe was discovered, at least in part, by Daniel Kahneman and Amos Tversky. The idea that what we remember about a story after it's over, or an experience, or anything that we've gone through, is the peak moment and the end. That's all that we remember. To demonstrate this, there have been lots of experiments where, people are in some minor way tortured for, several minutes by, for example, having their hand in a bowl of ice water. If the final part of that experience is a little bit better than the earlier part, asked to repeat it and given a couple of options, they'll opt for the longer, painful experience just because the ending is better. And this is kind of extraordinary, but I think it's a fairly...
And It is extraordinary. It may not be true, but okay, keep going.
Okay. You know, it seems to be true, but, you know, I'm open to... it does suggest, you know, why we're so, you know, why we're so kind of devoted to having not necessarily a happy ending, but at least a satisfying ending to a story.
Well, I have a number of books I've read that where the ending ruined the book for me. Mm-hmm. I don't know if I should mention them or not. I think I won't. But, you know, it's a book that you're totally immersed in it. You know, and I'll just... Actually, both of them, they kill off the main character in the last 20 pages. And I'm, you know, I get to the I've got 20 pages to go and I'm going, you know, come on. You're not, are you? Oh, come on. And they do, they kill him off in an unsatisfying way. There are satisfying ways for a character to die at the end of a book. These were just sort of like, I can't think of a way to end the book. I guess I'll kill off the character.
Right.
Or if I don't kill off the character, I'll be accused of having a sort of, it's too cheery or whatever. Anyway, I think endings are incredibly important. I don't want to totally disagree with that research finding, but I do think beginnings are important. So it's just, the only things that are important are the beginning, the middle, and the end. So I'm being a little bit facetious there. I apologize. I want to talk about immersion and some of the, you know, in today's world, there's so many immersive aspects to storytelling. I want to talk about some non-immersive storytelling and see what your thoughts are on this. I just saw the movie Belfast, with the Kenneth Branagh film that's just come out. I saw it in a movie theater. Very interesting. I told people it's the best movie I've seen in 2 years, but of course it's the only movie I've seen in 2 years. It's since COVID, but it's a. I loved it. You may not, listeners, but I loved it. And you know, when it was over, I thought about it for a lot. I'm still thinking about it. I saw it about a week ago, and I'm still thinking about it. And there are a couple scenes that I loved, and so. One thing I did is I went back and I played there's a scene with Everlasting Love in it. It was a nice song, a nice pop song. And I've listened to that a few times because it reminds me of the movie. I found an interview with the two stars of the movie, and it's fun to see them with their imperfect, much less Irish accents in real life than they have in the movie, and to see what they look like in different makeup and clothing and see them chit-chat. And that was fun. But that's kind of it. I'm kind of done. I can't immerse myself any more in that story than, you know, Van Morrison. The soundtrack's all Van Morrison songs. So I like Van Morrison, and so I might listen to some – I might listen to the soundtrack. You can do that with a movie. But after that, with most movies until recently, that's all you got. How are those forms of entertainment in trouble? And is that one of the reasons that these large franchises are so effective for movie houses, because you have all the tie-in with merchandising and other you can have, you know, reunions with you can have, I don't know what they do, you know, get-togethers with Star Trek fans, all kinds of stuff like that, which not going to happen with a one-shot movie like this. Are they in trouble? Is that one of the reasons they're in trouble? They're rare.
Yeah, they're certainly rare as movies. I think one thing that's happened is that in the last 40 years or so, television and movies have switched places. You know, it used to be that, you know, movies were the prestige medium, and you got to tell as a director, you got to tell great stories. As an actor, you got, you know, meaty roles, and that was great. Whereas with television, it was obviously, you know, the lowest common denominator medium. It had to appeal to everybody. And if it didn't, you were in trouble. With the rise of digital, with the rise of cable and satellite, with the, you know, proliferation of channels and now streaming services, you know, that's obviously no longer the case. And, you know, in fact, you can make a very strong argument that the more you know, different your characters are and your story is, the more sort of distinct it is and original, the better off you're going to be. Because what you're really looking for is a strong niche audience.
Whereas a passionate fan base that's going to do all the other stuff.
Exactly. Whereas with movies, what's happened is, you know, with the rise of international, which, 20, 30 years ago was a complete afterthought. But now with the building of multiplexes in cities around the world, international box office outdraws in most cases the domestic box office, considerably. The problem, of course, being language, and especially with comedy, notoriously doesn't translate. And, so with all of that, it's really movies that are becoming the, or have become, you could argue, the lowest common denominator medium. And, the other thing is that movies cost so much to make, especially, movies that rely on a great deal of computer generated imagery, which is most movies today, whether they're science fiction or not, so expensive to make that you have to have pre-existing characters. You have to have characters that people already know about and want to go, or at least that's the theory in Hollywood. That's the theory at the studios, and so. I think that's what's really happening there.
It's a fantastic point about the way the international market has caused it to be much more of a common denominator medium. There was the other factor in terms of TV, as talked about it before, is that when the price of televisions became low enough in real terms that you could have multiple ones throughout the house, different people could watch in their own rooms different stuff, which allowed for that niche that otherwise it would be vetoed in a majority rule or whatever system people were using to decide what to watch that night. It'd have to appeal more or less to everybody in the house. Once you could watch your own TV, you got much more interesting and customized products. I can't help but think, as you were talking about that, about Broadway shows, which haven't changed, they've changed hardly at all. I mean, some of the special effects are more ambitious now than they used to be, but I just, one thing which I think is underappreciated about Broadway, and I've never understood this, why it's not more appreciated, is after a Broadway show, there is a tradition that the stars of the show come out on the street and hang out with the audience. It is one of the most remarkable things, right? I'm sitting there watching a 3-minute, not so interesting conversation between the two stars of Belfast. Their banter is not that high quality when it's unscripted, but I can talk to Norm Lewis, who's like a giant, and thank him. I can thank the stars that I've just seen that have poured their heart out for me in my presence. And there's usually like 30 people hanging around. I guess they have better things to do, or it's cold out at night in New York. But I do think that's a wonderful immersive part of Broadway shows that is undervalued or under. Maybe it's not known. Maybe most people don't know.
Yeah,
but you can.
That's fascinating. I love that. And I think it also goes to show. It's a different way of immersing yourself in the story. You obviously know it's a fiction, these are actors, and so forth. And yet you get to learn more, you get to meet them. It's great. A lot of my thinking in the last 10 or 12 years has been influenced by this interview that I did with James Cameron. I was at, as you probably know, I was at Wired Magazine. I was a writer there for 10 years, from 1999 to 2009. And in 2006, I was doing a piece on 3D. And Cameron, of course, had, after Titanic, had gone off and invented the stereoscopic camera system with a guy named Vince Pace. And in 2006, he was in Montreal on the soundstage where they were shooting a film. Another director was shooting a film that would be the first feature film using the stereoscopic camera system that Pace and had invented, Pace and Cameron. And the film, by the way, was called Journey 3D. It was a take on Journey to the Center of the Earth, a remake in 3D. And so Cameron was there just to, see what was happening, see how the camera system worked and so forth. And he didn't really have much to do, so I got a lot of time to talk with him. And one of the things, of course, that I asked him about was Avatar, which at that point has been in development for, a decade or so, and which was widely expected to be his next film, but had not yet been greenlit by Fox. So I asked him about this, and he said, well, he didn't want to talk about it very much, but he would say that, he saw it as sort of an Edgar Rice Burroughs-style action-adventure film that happens to take place on another planet. Edgar Rice Burroughs, of course, being the author of Tarzan. So,
but he did have a few other books that took place on ones. I was a big Edgar Rice Burroughs fan in my youth. So.
right, of course. So anyway, he went on to say that for him, the best way to tell such a story was to create a kind of almost like fractal experience where if you were a casual fan, you could just watch the movie and that would be fine. That would be enough. But if you were a more committed fan, you could go deeper and deeper and the pattern would still hold. And that's what I think is going on right now with this idea of immersion. And you're quite right. The stage door is a great example of this, and an example that there's nothing ultimately new about it, certainly nothing new about the audience's desire for it. There are lots of movies, lots of TV shows where you can just be a casual fan, and Broadway plays too, for that matter. You can just be a casual fan and that's enough. But if you care about, if you really care about what's the story that's being told, if it really speaks to you, if you, very much identify with, one of the lead characters, then you're going to want to go deeper. You're going to want to learn more. I mean, I just, the other night, I watched a film on TV called The Dig that was produced by Netflix. And it was the true story, more or less. A couple of things happened that didn't actually, but it's a true story about the discovery in a remote part of coastal England on the verge of World War II, like literally in the summer of 1939, when a local landowner had these mounds that had been, on her property and wanted to find out what they were about. And so she hired a sort of a self-taught local archaeologist to dig. And what he found ultimately was what's been billed as, not by the people who made the movie, what's been billed as the, greatest archaeological find, funerary find in Europe to date. It was a ship, an Anglo-Saxon ship from the early 7th century, so around 620, 630 AD, in which was buried some great man. The ship had disintegrated, but there was the ghost of it in the ground. There was a huge treasure, surrounding the person who had been buried. The person had long since disintegrated as well, the body, but the gold and silver and, the elaborate things that were buried with him were still there. And so this was totally fascinating. I wanted to know more about the characters. I wanted to know, I spent the next 2 or 3 hours on Wikipedia and other such resources, sussing out the details of this story.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, and she had these two mounds and she hired this local archaeologist and they dug and they didn't find anything, just just some dirt. And that's not much of a story.
Yeah, right.
There's a lot of excitement, but if the ending is not interesting, and you got a pretty good ending there, shipwreck from the 7th century. I was hoping it was going to be, they found the pieces of an airplane that had been lost in a TV show called Lost, but right. Can't have everything, I guess. That could resolve two shows. I'm curious. I don't want to sound too judgmental about this, but is there something unusual or interesting about the fact that people want to go deeper? I understand And maybe just the same, they're just the same thing, that you might want to find out how much this story was true. You get on Wikipedia, you find out more than they had time to share in the article, in the movie. But going deeper into a fictional character, isn't that a little bit, and I get it, right? They create, there are these web pages now with, you know, every detail about every character that's ever appeared on such, on a particular show like Game of Thrones. And presumably, like Sherlock, you could continue to have the character evolve after the show ends, right? You could imagine different things that weren't true. Well, they wouldn't be true. The curse is fictional. But just an interesting thing that human beings, we want those. We have these imaginary friends. There are the characters in our novels, the characters in our movies. We care about them. And we just did a show that's airing this week on, you can talk about our mirror neurons, right? Our right. Emotions are triggered by these things, even when we know they're not real. We cry when they die. We're happy for them when they succeed in the program. It's a fascinating thing.
Yeah, no, it's totally fascinating. And, you know, there's long been, I think, lots of people have wondered, you know, why do we tell ourselves stories that we know are not true, right? And when the birth of the novel in the 17th and 18th century, the novel was considered, well, first off, the reason it was called novel was because it was so new. It was a new form of storytelling that, you know, was native to, you know, the printing press and movable type. At the same time, it was, it was considered a branch of history, but it had the distinct disadvantage of not being true. So it was a false branch of history.
Yeah.
By the 19th century and the rise of people like Dickens and so forth, sort of attitude, fell away. But there has been a lot of, a lot of people have been interested in this subject and have wanted to, you know, go deeper and sort of try to understand it. One of them is Brian Boyd, who's one of my favorite authors. He's probably the world's leading authority on Nabokov. He wrote a two-volume biography. He's written books about various Nabokov novels and so forth. He's a professor of English at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. And some years ago, I think around 2009, he published a book called On the Origin of Stories, which is essentially a literary Darwinist, look at storytelling. And fiction in particular. And he concluded, if I can, sort of wrap this up very, succinctly, that, and probably oversimplify, but he concluded that we care about these stories because they're essentially teaching us things. They're teaching us how to behave in the world. Mm-hmm. What works and what doesn't. And furthermore, when you have kids who are, who want to hear the same story or watch the same story over and over and over again every night, that kind of immersion is, coming at that age, at such a young age when they're first coming to grips with the world and trying to understand this crazy world that they've been born into. I think that's a really key understanding, I think, of why fiction matters to us. And another thing that I find really interesting, there is a woman named Melanie Green who is she's now a professor of psychology at the University of Buffalo in New York State. And in the 90s, she did a remarkable piece of research. She was then a grad student at Ohio State. And what she wanted to know was, would stories be more likely to change our attitudes about whatever the subject of the story was, if we were more immersed in the story or less immersed in the story? And I won't go into the details of how she found out, but it's pretty interesting. And essentially, she found out that yes, the more the more immersed we are in a story, the more likely we are to come away with beliefs that are consonant with the story. That the story might reinforce. So almost as like a side question to this, she wanted to know if it mattered if the story was true or not, and. Very interestingly, she formatted, she gave people a short story to read, and she formatted the story in two different ways. One group of people got it as a short story, as a piece of fiction that was reprinted from a literary magazine. Another group of people got the exact same story formatted as a newspaper article. So one was fiction, putatively, and one was truth. And what she found there was that it made no difference whatsoever. Whether people were told the story was true or false, the only thing that mattered in terms of the story changing their attitudes was how immersed they were in the story.
Well, it's interesting. I guess immersion is an example of authenticity, something else you write about, and I think... Right, a great book is credible if the characters seem real.
Right.
I think when I think about the comic book revolution that Marvel started, the real thing that they did, that Stan Lee and his team did, was to create characters with flaws. Spider-Man had to deal with the death of his parents. He had to deal with his own insecurities. Right. He made jokes, right? A part of I read Spider-Man when I was probably 13. And it had a big impact on my sense of humor, Marvel Comics. They were ironic, and they were self-referential, and they're very modern. They had a huge, I think it's an underappreciated fact, phenomenon that Marvel, I think, had an enormous impact on humor, not just the superhero genre, but they humanized the superhero, I think, was what was clever about it. And that made them more authentic.
Right.
And I think a great novel is data. It's like you say, you learn something about the world. It's one data point, but if the person isn't realistic, doesn't strike you as credible, doesn't live by the human principles you expect, then you don't take it seriously. But if they do, then you can immerse yourself in it.
Right.
And then it can be a source of understanding for you. I think that's very important. I want to close with something I just realized, which is this quote that I had earlier that you have as well, that I put it together, but you say both these things, that human beings are pattern-seeking, storytelling animals. I always think of I don't actually hear what those words are, because I always think of it as people like to listen to stories when I say that. The people like to hear stories, but it's storytelling, not story listening. And one of the observations you make in the book, and it's an observation by chance I also heard over the last week or so, is that there are more people making movies than watching them. There are more people writing than reading. What Twitter and social media and TikTok and YouTube have done is really, we think of it as the attention question, which you have a lot of things to say about, which we're not going to get to, but I enjoyed them. It's really the maker revolution. It's the chance for people who normally would be unable to tell stories to tell them. They're not that interesting. Sometimes they're, they might be 30 seconds long or 3 minutes long, but it's what we want right now. And the technology has liberated the human spirit. I'm going to wax rhapsodical for a minute, perhaps inappropriately given how some of these things are also destructive, as we know. But it's really liberated human beings to be much more creative and to tell stories, not just watch them, not just listen to them. Just react to that.
Yeah, no, that's a totally fascinating phenomenon. And, I think that, one measure of this is that it's fan fiction. I mean, I'm sort of a great believer in the the idea that technology doesn't really change us. It just makes possible aspects of our personalities or our desires that weren't made possible before. And what you're talking about here is a great example of that, because, you know, there's been a lot written about the democratization of the technology of communications. You know, anybody can make a video now. You know, anybody can write something and post it. Sure, that's true, but it happened before. It just wasn't obvious. It wasn't apparent. I mean, fan fiction being the perfect example. You know, there's nothing new about fan fiction. It's just that before the internet, it was underground. You know, sort of by necessity, because there was no, you know, real way for it to surface.
What do you mean by fan fiction?
Good question. Fan fiction being fiction that's written by fans of a certain story, a certain franchise, that, you know, sort of takes the characters and puts them in new situations. So, and you know, there's now no end of fan fiction available, and you know, some of it has. You know, has become hugely popular. And, you know, what I think people are starting to realize is that there's no, you know, intellectual property, including stories of any sort, is fundamentally different from physical property, and it actually benefits from being shared. And it took people a long time to come to this realization, but I think increasingly a lot of, you know, movie and studios, television networks, and so forth have come to this realization. But the other thing I like to keep in mind is, you know, what I call narrative thinking. And narrative thinking is essentially being aware of the sea we swim in, being aware that we live in this constant sea of stories, and that we, you know, whether as storytellers or as, you know, story listeners, viewers, whatever, we are using this to make sense of the world. You know, the brain is a pattern-seeking organ. It will see patterns in all kinds of stuff, whether they make sense or not. You know, there are no end of places where people have seen cloud formations that look like the Virgin Mary, you know, or condensation on a glass or a window. And you know, so this is just pattern recognition. There doesn't actually have to be, you know, even necessarily a real pattern there, just something that suggests a pattern. And it does have to do with our making sense of the world. And so, you know, stories are, you know, really key to that. And I think that's, you know, that's sort of the underlying reality behind the, you know, the very first question you asked about advertising. You know, we use stories to make sense of the world, and a smart advertiser will recognize this and play to it. So that's, I think, you know, what's really going on here. This idea of narrative thinking, you know, that we have to be aware of the role of stories in our lives, and the role of stories being, you know, largely to provide us with patterns that show us, you know, in some way or another, what's going on.
My guest today has been Frank Rose. His book is The Sea We Swim In. Frank, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thanks, Russ. Great to be here.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.